all of these constraints that make it difficult for women to move around in the public space have a huge economic cost. And so we should be thinking about what are the broader ways that we can invest in making women safe in the public space.
Welcome to Vox Dev Talks. My name is Tim Phillips. A fundamental part of women's economic empowerment is helping women who want to work outside the home to find and keep a job. And a major part of that is ensuring that they can travel to work without fear of stigma, harassment, or violence on public transport. In Pakistan, a study set out to discover whether an offer of safe commuter transport would tempt women who are currently not looking for a job into the workplace. Kate Virbourne of the World Bank is one of the researchers who worked on the project. I caught up with her in Lahore, where the study took place. Kate, welcome.
Thank you so much, Tim. It's great to be here and have a chance to talk about this work.
It is fascinating work, Kate. It's about women's participation in the labour market. Now, I know historically in South Asia, women's participation in the labour market has been low. What are the numbers for this?
In South Asia, women's participation in the labour force is low, and it's lower than we might tend to expect, considering the GDPs of countries in the region. So compared to other developing countries in other regions, South Asian countries tend to have fewer women participating in the labor force. So in Pakistan in particular, which is the country that we're studying here, we see that about one in four women is active and working, according to DHS statistics. But an important thing to note is that we see from that survey, which is one in which women are also asked whether they would be interested in working if they could find a suitable job. Another one in four women say, yes, if I found a suitable job, I would be interested in working. And so that one issue that's come up as a theme in a lot of our work in this space is that there are many women who appear to be what we consider latent workers. Like, they're not working, they're not searching for jobs, possibly because they don't think they can find any that they can reach, or because they don't think that there's any demand for their work. But there's this possibility that when they are offered opportunities, they do respond. And so that's something I think we're seeing coming up again and again in our work, as well as in work of other teams in the region.
This intervention takes place in Lahore, big city environment. How typical is Lahore of the rest of Pakistan?
So Lahore is more urban and more of a diversified economy than other parts of Pakistan. In many ways, it's more socially liberal. But in general, in urban areas, we tend to see that women's mobility is actually more constrained in urbanized areas than it is in rural areas. And that could be for a number of reasons, one of which is that cities tend to be quite anonymous and potentially dangerous. So there's more risk of crime and harassment. So even though it's a big and fairly socially liberal setting, women's mobility is really constrained by safety and social norms.
Now, if you're doing research in this area and we're gathering data on women in the workplace and out of the workplace, how difficult is it to get representative data? Because you're looking at women who have been discouraged, perhaps, by the problems of commuting. It must be quite hard to find them, though.
Yes, absolutely. So we have great representative data in the form of the Pakistan Labor Force Survey, which is carried out regularly. And so we can use that to answer questions like how many women are working and whether they're unemployed in the sense of not working, but searching. But one thing that's not covered very well in the labor force survey is this idea that you just alluded to of women being discouraged from searching, not searching because they think they can't find something or they can't find something that they can access. And so the DHS survey, which I just mentioned, does ask this general question about willingness to take up a job, but it doesn't dig more into it. That's not the purpose of that survey. As a part of this study and this research program, one of the contributions, I think, the first level that we hope to make is by documenting this point. And we've seen this in multiple studies in this research program, that there are a lot of women out there that they're not working, they're not searching, but when you offer them an opportunity to search for jobs, they do take it up and they spend time and effort searching. And when you provide opportunities for them that are feasible for them to reach, they are interested, they do apply for those. So I think that's really suggestive that there is a lot of latent supply, women who are out there that are not working, they're not searching, but they would like to work. And if some opportunity comes up, they could take it up.
Let's take a break. We'll be back in a moment.
Throughout West Africa, women leaders are driving meaningful change.
You have to think about the way the country looks at its women and how it views its girls.
Hear their stories in the podcast, Women Leading Change, brought to you by the Sahel and West Africa Club at the OECD.
We've neglected our indigenous foods, which were historically very healthy.
I'm your host, Dr. Lena Coney-Hoffman. Tune in and be inspired as we explore the connections between gender and climate change, food systems, conflict, and urban expansion.
Women have risen to protect their children, to protect their families, to protect communities in the face of real terrorism.
To discover that appetite to be able to work those latent job seekers, you set up a job matching platform. That's incredibly ambitious. How could you do this?
I've been increasingly interested over the course of my research career in trying to make not just the findings of the research study at the end useful through policy, which is the first order thing we're trying to do, but also wherever possible to also build in an opportunity for the research subjects during the study to benefit more immediately. And so one thing that people often do to help compensate research participants for their time and effort is just by giving them a small gift as a thank you. And that's a great thing. We do that in some studies. In this case, we actually went quite a few steps further by providing them a service that they could then use, which is the access to this job search platform that we set up as part of the research. And that job platform is called Job Talash. It means job search in Urdu. And we started out with a slightly less ambitious idea of just having a simple hotline and seeing whether women who we offered transport to would call the hotline. But it evolved in part because what we saw was that women didn't have access to information about jobs. They didn't have access to information about what jobs are located in what places. And therefore, if you offered them transport, they wouldn't know if they could get to those jobs through that transport. And so we ultimately ended up recruiting firms, asking them to post jobs with us, and then randomizing which of the opportunities had transport, and then providing that all of that information to the male and female job seekers in the study so that they could make one unified decision. Okay, I see that there's an opportunity for a receptionist. It's in this particular neighborhood, and there is going to be a transport that allows me to get to it, or there isn't a transport that allows me to get to it. And that allows us to control for everything else that might be going on, make sure everybody has all the full information they need to be able to make a decision.
And we really must emphasize that these are real firms offering real jobs in the real economy.
Yes, absolutely. This is something that's been studied in other settings with maybe hypotheticals or something more temporary. These are firms that we asked to post real full-time in-person off-platform jobs, such as a receptionist job, the example that I just mentioned. We recruited firms from a representative sample and also accepted firms that approached us. And as a result, we have the whole range of education levels of types of jobs. So firms post sweeper jobs on Job Talash, they post HR manager jobs, they post beautician jobs. So it's really meant to represent and cover the whole economy.
Tell me about these firms. How did you encourage them to sign up? Do they traditionally recruit many female employees?
The first kind of thing that we did was just to identify areas in the city that have commercial locations. Those could be offices, it could be shops, they could be other kinds of places that people work outside the home. And we did door-to-door listing with a flyer. So we had basically pretty substantial field presence going around promoting the service for free to the firms. And that's why they take it up. It's a free service that can help them recruit. And the majority of the firms in the sample start out without female employees, but many of them do post an ad for a job that is open to female employees. And so it's also sort of suggestive that there are firms out there that don't have women, but are at least willing to consider hiring them. The other thing that's worth noting here, which is a subject of another study that this team is running, is this issue that the firms that we recruit into the sample typically don't start out posting their jobs anywhere. They typically recruit employees through networks. I need somebody. I'm just going to ask around my friends, my colleagues, my cousins, do you know anybody that can do this job? We are doing some other work trying to explore this and the gender implications of it, because in a gender segregated society, which is the case in Pakistan in many dimensions, the network-based hiring will tend to favor men by default. And so this is another kind of dimension that we try to break into besides the transport one.
Now, Kate, also, you need to get job seekers onto the platform, and you need to find a different type of job seeker who would traditionally sign up, because there's no point in you just signing up people who are working already and just looking for another job.
Yes, absolutely.
Yeah, so basically, how do you do that?
So that's also a pretty big field exercise. So our team visited about 50,000 households in randomly selected clusters all across the metropolitan area, and listed who were the adults that lived there, men and women, and then offered the opportunity for any or all of them to sign up for the job search service. Again, it was all free. So that's where we really get this first finding that there are many women who have at least some tentative interest in signing up for the platform, even though they're not working at baseline. Then if they're interested, then we set up a call center, and that call center calls to those individuals as a follow-up and ask them to complete some basic sign-up information, including populating a very simple CV and answering a few baseline questions. And that also gives us a measure of how much women are interested in joining the labor force, because we do see that that takes some effort, kind of picking up the phone and answering all those questions to populate the CV. It takes some effort. And so people will do that if they're interested in participating in some way in the labor market. And we see that there's a huge fraction of women who do sign up that are neither working nor actively searching at baseline. So what that means is that all the effort we went to go door to door and find them was worthwhile and was a kind of a good investment of effort, because we found all these women that if we had just gone to, say, a job search service or place an ad in the newspaper, we probably wouldn't have found.
And your intention here is to make it possible for women to take jobs because there is an offer of transport. What sort of transport can you offer them if traditional forms of public transport are not encouraging them to work?
In this setting, in Lahore in Pakistan, the really large employers that do have a lot of women, so those could be things like call centers, universities, hospitals, what you'll tend to see is that they actually offer a pick and drop service for their employees.
Right. Mm-hmm.
So it would be like a small van or similar kind of a vehicle that goes to all their houses and picks them up. At some point when I was a guest instructor at a university here, I rode one of these every day to go and teach my classes, picking up all of the instructors. A lot of them were women, taking them to the work location, and then at the end of the day, dropping them all back home again. So it's a little bit like a school bus. That is a really great solution for a lot of people. And what you'll see if you chat with women here is that they're very keen on working for an employer that provides that, because it's super convenient, it's safe, you don't get harassed. The issue is very few employers actually provide that. It's just something like 1 or 2% in our sample. And the reason is because it only makes sense to run your own van if you've got a lot of female employees already. If you just have one, it's not going to make sense. What we tend to see is that men aren't interested in this kind of service because it's safe and acceptable for them to do things like ride the bus, ride the motorcycle. You'd end up running a van for just one person and it becomes cost prohibitive. So the idea of what we did in the study was to take what the big employers that do have women do and replicate it in a way that we could help multiple employers nearby each other share it together. So a pick and drop service that's coordinated and helps to kind of bridge that gap for employers across the spectrum, because most employers are not the really big universities and hospitals. Those are important employers too, but there are tons of firms out there that have said that they're potentially open to hiring women, but just aren't of the scale that can afford to do that.
And for the purposes of this research, were you paying the cost of the transport?
We were paying part of the cost. So we very randomly a subsidy us. And the goal of that is to help us understand the potential for scale and how much people really value an offer of transport. And in particular, the additional thing that we add to one treatment arm in the randomized trial is women-only transport. The goal of the study is to understand how big of a constraint on women's potential participation in the labor force is it that they can't get to work safely. We want to break that down into cost and the safety and acceptability constraints. And so by doing both a randomization of the cost, like the how much we subsidize, and a randomization of whether it's a women-only vehicle or a mixed gender vehicle that we offer, we're able to sort of separate those out.
What are you measuring as an outcome here? Is it job matches, job applications? What's success?
In the study, we're able to look at job applications. That's our measure of labor supply. So that's whether a woman is deciding to move forward with potential job opportunity. We don't focus on further downstream outcomes, in part because that's then a function of a lot of other things that may be going on, including whether the woman is the best qualified candidate for the job, whether the hiring manager she meets is sexist, many, many other things that can be going on, many of which we then unpack in other studies using the same platform. But for this transport one, we really focus on, can women's labor supply increase if we offer transport? And what we see is that indeed an offer of transport, in particular an offer of women-only transport, can not just increase, but double or triple the rate at which women apply for jobs. So if they see an ad that is just a normal ad, they'll apply at a certain rate. If they see an ad with exact same information in it, but also offering this pick and drop to get to and from work, they're 2 to 3 times as likely to apply depending on the conditions in the subsidy level.
So Kate, this has been very successful with subsidized transport, but as you pointed out, this is really only viable for firms that have a lot of female employees, call centers, universities. Could this be sustainable if the employers or the employees had to bear the full cost of the service?
It depends. We do an exercise in the paper to understand what does this look like for different kinds of opportunities and different kinds of candidates. It costs a certain amount to run a van, whether the person sitting on it is a sweeper making, 10,000 rupees a month, or whether the person is an HR manager making 250,000 rupees a month, right? And so whether it's actually going to be sustainable depends a lot on the earning power of that person. If she's an HR manager, then it's going to be a very reasonable fraction of her salary. If she's a sweeper, it might be costing more than her salary for the firm to pay her full cost, sort of doubling the effective cost of employing that woman. Taking the whole sample all together, it does become cost prohibitive very quickly, especially as you get a little bit further away from women's homes, but within the same metro area, to run a pick and drop door-to-door service. So I guess, what do we do with that information? I guess there's a few key takeaways. One is that you could imagine a scenario in which it's possible to get more of women's employment off the ground through medium-term subsidies. So you can imagine that a firm that starts out with few or no women can recruit more women if they get assistance with this sort of transport. And then ultimately that brings the costs down, because if you have many women, then it becomes more cost effective. That still only makes sense if you have ultimately kind of potential for enough women to be working in close proximity, either in one big firm or in a large number of small firms in one location. The second thing is, if you think about a woman's, especially an educated woman's, earning power over the course of her career, it looks very, very different at the beginning when she's doing an internship, a traineeship, her first job out of college, than it does maybe 2-3 years later when she's earning more. And so that's another dimension in which we might think about temporary support for this sort of constraint. The final kind of more zoomed out thing to take away from this is, pick and drop is not necessarily going to be very easy to scale, and to scale in a cost-effective way. But what the study tells us is that all of these constraints that make it difficult for women to move around in the public space have a huge economic cost. And so we should be thinking about, what are the broader ways besides pick and drop that we can invest in making women safe in the public space? And there's a whole bunch of them. I have a colleague in my team at the World Bank, the Sargil team, Sophia Amaral, who has a really fantastic study looking at what happens when you have female police officers on the street visible. Does that reduce harassment of women? And that team finds that they can actually reduce harassment in the public space with police officer presence. And I think that's a great example of public policy issue that our study speaks to. Their study showed that you can reduce harassment with certain interventions. What we're showing is that if you could make it safe for women in the public space, that has an economic benefit. So I think about these different pieces of work as fitting together to all create a picture of a set of different policies that we should be pursuing to make it possible for women to move safely and comfortably in the public space and participating in the economy.
Yes, because it's not an entirely straightforward jigsaw to put together, is it, Kate? Because on the one hand, your shadow transport service solves an immediate problem, and financially, it must be subsidized, because one of the aims of this is to get people into work, and their earning power, at least initially, is not going to be very good. So fantastic. But of course, then if you rely too much on this in policy terms, then you are never going to change those norms, which ultimately we might want to think, well, that's what we could target. It's difficult to work out what the priorities are here.
I think that's exactly right. And actually, we have another paper which is studying this issue that you just alluded to in a very different context, which is Brazil.
Mm-hmm.
So this is a different team that I'm also a part of. We have a study that was recently published in the Journal of Development Economics looking at the issue of women-only transport in Brazil and how women value it and how that plays into stigma that might be associated with moving in mixed spaces. Now, Brazil, unlike Pakistan, is a place where you would think it's a pretty socially liberal place. Or is there really even any kind of a problem with this? And the answer is there's definitely a problem. There's huge levels of sexual harassment in the public space. This is a study and specifically in the setting of Rio. And what we find there is that women do put value on being able to move into a women-only space. In that paper, we do dive more into this issue of norms and stigma. And what we see there is that there is definitely a norm that says, you know, hey, there's a women-only space. That means if you're in the mixed space, it's kind of your fault if you get harassed.
Yeah.
That's definitely a problem. We do document that in a number of ways in some surveys and some exercises that we do with commuters. But the study also suggests that it doesn't appear that the existence of the women-only space is reinforcing that norm, that it's stronger as a result of the women-only space. It sort of plays into it, but we don't see evidence that it makes it stronger. So I would argue that realistically, especially in a much more conservative setting like Pakistan, where gender segregation is the norm, having a safe space in transit, which is one of the most difficult settings in which to grapple with this issue of harassment, is a very reasonable sort of accommodation for this problem in the medium to long term. The concern that reinforcing negative norms is an understandable concern, but I think about it as kind of a gateway in the sense that as a woman, if you're stuck at home because you can't get safely to anywhere else, then having a safe segregated space on transport can allow you to get to so many different possible places. You can get to a job, you can earn, develop your potential, learn and take advantage of all of those opportunities. It can allow you to go out and participate in so many other aspects of society. Those places don't have to be segregated. The most anonymous, most crowded, most vulnerable setting, which is a crowded bus, that's a setting that is arguably going to make things much easier if you segregate it for women ultimately to come out and participate in non-segregated public spaces. Participating in non-segregated public spaces is maybe easier for a lot of women because they have access to a segregated way to get there.
Kate, it's very interesting. Good luck with the research. Thank you very much.
Thanks so much, Tim.
This is work by Kate Viborni, Erica Field, and Syed Uzair Junaid. You can download the paper from IGC. It is called Women's Mobility and Labour Supply, Experimental Evidence from Pakistan. And the website for that is theigc.org. There will be a new version of this paper out soon, and we'll update our link when that becomes available.